Hello and welcome to the Verity Podcast for Friday, May the 10th, 2024. We're the only podcast that keeps separating the fact from the narrative spin. I'm Adam Clark.
And I'm Melissa Topshire with today's headlines. Biden says the U.S. will not supply offensive weapons for a Rafah assault.
Sudan's rapid support forces are accused of ethnic cleansing in West Darfur.
The U.S. House tables a motion to remove Speaker Mike Johnson.
RFK Jr.'s campaign says he's in robust health despite a brain worm scare.
Putin says he has no doubt that Russia will be victorious in Ukraine.
The EU ends its military training mission in Mali.
A whistleblower claims Boeing planes' parts had serious defects.
Saudi forces are allegedly told to use lethal force to clear land for an eco-city.
Spain's ex-soccer chief will stand trial for the Hermosa kiss.
And a deaf toddler hears after gene therapy.
The Biden administration says the U.S. won't supply offensive weapons for a Rafah assault. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the Associated Press, The Times of Israel, CBS, and Reuters. U.S. President Joe Biden said Wednesday that if Israel invades Rafah, the U.S. will not supply the weapons and artillery shells used. Biden said the U.S. is committed to Israel's security, but acknowledged for the first time that U.S. weapons have killed civilians in Gaza. Biden's comments came after it was earlier reported that the U.S. would not supply Israel with a shipment of 502,000-pound bombs. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin confirmed the weapons delay, telling a Senate subcommittee that the U.S. paused one shipment of high-payload munitions. IDF spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari said Thursday that the Israeli military has enough munitions for its planned operations in Rafah. Hagari called U.S. support for Israel unprecedented during the war and said that disagreements can be solved behind closed doors. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu previously said if Israel is forced to stand alone, Israel will stand alone. Right-wing members of his government strongly criticized Biden's comments Thursday, with one member of Netanyahu's Likud party saying Biden's actions jeopardize the entire free world. Meanwhile, Israeli negotiators left Cairo on Thursday as the details of ceasefire talks remained hazy. Though the current situation is unclear, negotiations have seemingly once again stalled. Also, Cypriot officials said a vessel carrying aid to a pier built by the U.S. military off the coast of Gaza left the port of Larnaca on Thursday, contradicting reports that aid would be subject to inspection by Israeli forces when it arrived. Officials said there would be no further checks.
Thank you, Melissa, for the facts on our first story today. I'm going to start our first round of narrative spins with the pro-establishment narrative, and that's been written by the New York Times. The U.S. is committed to preventing malicious actions from threatening Israel's legitimate concerns and making sure Israel can defend itself from terror. However, the humanitarian situation in Gaza has gotten out of hand, and the Biden administration wouldn't support further offensive action in Rafah. Netanyahu must keep his promises to work with U.S. allies to resolve this conflict.
The Jerusalem Post brings us a pro-Israel narrative. There's only one word to describe the Biden administration's current policy toward Israel: betrayal. At the climax of this war, Biden has unilaterally decided the opinions of pro-Hamas fanatics are more important than Israel's legitimate security concerns. Other U.S. allies should take heed.
We're going to wrap up this spin of narratives with a pro-Palestine narrative provided by Al Jazeera. After over half a year of grinding brutality, the Biden administration is running damage control for its grotesque policies. The U.S. has helped Israel destroy Gaza every step of the way, and now that the deed is done, the U.S. wants to end offensive arms shipments. It's simply too little, too late. News out of Sudan, where there are new details of alleged ethnic cleansing emerging out of West Darfur. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Human Rights Watch, The Guardian, UN News, and Voice of America. Thousands of people have been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced in attacks by the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF, and allied militias as part of a wider ethnic cleansing campaign in Sudan's West Darfur, according to a Human Rights Watch report released on Thursday. Following the outbreak of the Sudanese civil war between the Sudanese military and the RSF, an Arab-led paramilitary force, in April of 2023, HRW collated 221 witness statements documenting the alleged campaign of ethnic cleansing conducted by the RSF forces against Sudan's non-Arab Masalit tribe of El Janina in an ethnically diverse region. One of the events highlighted by the report was on June 15th of 2023, when RSF paramilitaries allegedly went on a spree in El Janina, the capital of West Darfur. Witnesses described summary executions of civilians, including children being piled up and shot, as well as torture, looting, rape, and other forms of sexual violence. As a result of the violence, more than 570,000 people, mainly Masalites and members of other non-Arab groups, now live in refugee camps in Chad. While exact figures are unknown, between 10,000 to 15,000 civilians are thought to have been killed in El Janina in 2023 alone. Last week, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs described the crisis as one of epic proportions, stating that more than 25 million people, more than half of the population, need assistance, and that close to 18 million people face acute food insecurity. Meanwhile, the U.S. warned that over 2 million people in North Darfur's El Fasher are at risk of a large-scale massacre by the RSF and their allied militias, who they say began razing several villages west of El Fasher.
All right, Adam, thank you for those facts. We'll begin this round of spins with a pro-establishment narrative from Voice of America. This is a humanitarian catastrophe of epic proportions, with reports that more massacres could be coming. UN officials and diplomats from a number of countries are doing all they can to de-escalate the situation, urging all parties to respect the sanctity of human life and international humanitarian law.
Crisis Group has prepared the establishment critical narrative. It's undisputed that the situation in Sudan is calamitous and needs urgent attention. However, rather than getting better, the situation appears to be getting worse and appears to be exacerbated by the fact that diplomats haven't come up with a cognate strategy and are fighting among themselves about how to go about solving the problem.
And here's a nerd narrative from Metaculus saying there's a 50% chance that South Sudan will no longer be classified as being in a state of civil war by July 2028. The House tables a motion to remove Speaker Johnson. Here are the facts as agreed upon by USA Today, The New York Times, The Daily Caller, BBC News, and Al Jazeera. The U.S. House on Wednesday retained Representative Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, as Speaker when it voted 359 to 43 to table a motion to vacate the chair 15 minutes after it was introduced. The motion put forward by Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, was rejected with unprecedented bipartisanship, as members of a minority party had never voted in favor of the other party's Speaker. But all but 39 Democrats joined with all but 11 Republicans to maintain Johnson in his post. Green's motion accused Johnson of failing to live up to his promises to advance the Republicans' agenda and instead choosing to ally himself with Democrats. Democratic leadership promised to protect Johnson after he helped pass a foreign aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Green, who was booed during her Wednesday speech on the House floor, put a positive spin on the defeat of her motion with a post on X, formerly Twitter, saying, "The good news this morning is now the American people have been shown the truth about Democrats allegedly viewing Johnson as someone they can control." Previously, Green was among a group of Republicans who in October 2023 used the same procedure to remove Kevin McCarthy as Speaker. The first time in U.S. history, the body voted to remove its leader.
Thank you, Melissa, for the facts. Now I'm going to start with a spin, beginning with the pro-establishment narrative, and it's brought to us by Washington Post. In these partisan times, Green managed to unite both sides of the political aisle as she was booed and heckled leading up to her advancing of the motion to vacate. This was a victory for Congress over those who want dysfunction, and Green should tone down her act.
Here's the establishment critical narrative from PJ Media. The House has unity, but at what cost? Johnson now owes the Democrats for his survival as Speaker. There's no telling what policies will result now that he's beholden to the opposition party moving forward.
We've got some politically motivated spins continuing with a Republican narrative brought to us by Fox News. This is not the time for removing the Speaker and continuing any divisions in the Republican Party. It's crucial that the GOP shows a united face while it competes with the radical left Democrats. There are important elections coming up and a chance for a unified Republican Party to grow its House majority and retake the Senate.
And MSNBC brings us the Democratic narrative. Democrats were shrewd to show America it's the mature, responsible party at this point in time, in contrast to the chaos of the GOP. But Democrats also know that a replacement for Johnson would probably be someone from Green's wing of the party who wouldn't be as easy to work with. So the Democrats and a functioning Congress are the big winners.
The nerds are going to wrap up this spin with their opinion. They think that there's an 85% chance that Johnson will remain Speaker for all of 2024, according to the Metaculous Prediction Community. News off the campaign trail where RFK Jr. is in good health despite a brainworm scare. Here are the facts as agreed upon by BBC News, New York Times, Washington Post, X, and AOL. The campaign of independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in a statement confirmed a New York Times report saying he suffered significant memory loss and cognitive impairment from a brain worm he contracted in 2010, but also affirmed he's currently in robust health. According to the Times report, Kennedy also suffered from mercury poisoning and heart problems. Nonetheless, he has made his physical fitness, especially compared to older opponents President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, a centerpiece of his campaign. Kennedy campaign spokeswoman Stephanie Speer said Kennedy contracted the parasite during one of his many travels in Africa, Asia, and South America, and that his health problems were resolved over a decade ago. Kennedy, now 70, has also battled hepatitis C, which he contracted from intravenous heroin use as a young man, and he has suffered from an irregular heartbeat. Also, he has a distinctively strained and raspy voice due to a disorder that causes involuntary muscle spasms in the voice box. In a recent post on X, Kennedy joked, quote, "I offer to eat 5 more brain worms and still beat President Trump and President Biden in a debate." He added, "I feel confident of the result even with a 6-worm handicap."
Thank you, Adam, for those facts. Here's a narrative A from the Boston Herald. Kennedy continues to receive negative publicity from the corporate media. Given the competition, it's ironic the Times is making Kennedy's health a priority, unearthing an old story that has nothing to do with his current conditions. The best way to handle this story is to make fun of it and chalk it up to a smear of someone trying to shake up the system.
There's a narrative B provided by Fox. Kennedy can do all he wants to project a vigorous image in an attempt to impress voters and contrast himself with his competition, but his decision to hide his numerous health conditions, particularly the brain worm, raises serious doubts about his physical competence to be president and his trustworthiness.
And here's the word from the nerds at Metaculous. There's a 16% chance Kennedy will suspend his 2024 presidential campaign by October 22nd, 2024. Adam, I think a 6-worm handicap is a good name for a tequila. So if you feel like you want to go in with me, now's the time.
Yeah, well, let's get that copyrighted for sure. I'll buy us a webpage for that 6-worm handicap.
6WH. Yep, you heard it here first, folks.
Maybe we can make it kosher, and then we can call it 6-worm handicap. Oi! It'd be the first kosher tequila.
Putin has no doubt about a Russian victory in Ukraine. Here are the facts as agreed upon by TASS, Sky News, and the Moscow Times. As Russia marked Victory Day, the day celebrating the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II, on Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin declared he has no doubt that Russia would replicate the result in Ukraine. Thursday marked the 79th anniversary of the event and was commemorated, as every year, with a large military parade in Moscow's Red Square, in which Putin talked up the strength of Russia's armed forces. However, as pointed out by Western sources, only one tank was present, with most resources devoted to Ukraine. Similar to the previous year's address, Putin sought to draw parallels between World War II and the current conflict, leveling allegations that they were fighting Nazis in both instances. These accusations are strongly denied in Ukraine and in the West. Putin also made renewed references to the possible use of nuclear weapons, stating, "Russia will do everything to prevent a global clash, but at the same time, we will not allow anyone to threaten us. Our strategic forces are always on alert." Putin further added that Russia will continue to develop a mutually beneficial partnership and friendship with everyone who shares the values of freedom and justice, and advocates strict compliance with international law. The comments were considered to be directed at international actors.
Thank you, Melissa. We're going to start the spins with the pro-establishment narrative, and that's provided by Spectator. Rather than celebrate Russia's genuine triumph over fascism in 1945, Victory Day under Putin has become all about Russia's illegal war in Ukraine, a sign of how the country is turning into a military dictatorship under the autocrat's iron fist.
And here's the pro-Russia narrative from TASS. As the West continues to engage in historical revisionism of Russia's role in fighting fascism, while at the same time promoting neo-Nazi forces operating in Ukraine, Russia will never forget the sacrifice of its ancestors and will continue their memory against the new enemies the country faces.
The Metaculous Prediction community thinks that there's a 50% chance that Vladimir Putin will cease to hold office of President of Russia by December of 2028.
Okay, well, didn't he just get elected for another 6-year term? So That would mean something sneaky is going on.
And there's a 50% chance. So, you know, you never know what Metaculous is up to.
That's true.
They don't like to be wrong. Mm. That's why it's 50%.
Yeah. Real risk takers.
The EU ends its military training mission in Mali. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Reuters, Voice of America, The News International, Euractiv.com, Al Jazeera, and Barron's. The EU announced on Wednesday that it will end its military training mission in Mali when its current mandate expires on May 18th amid deteriorating ties between the bloc and the West African country. The decision not to renew the mission's mandate was reportedly taken after the, quote, evolution of the political and security situation, an assessment of the mission strategy and talks with the Malian authorities. Before its suspension in 2022, the mission trained Malian armed forces and members of the G5 Sahel, a multi-international counterterrorism unit, for more than a decade. The mission, deployed at the request of the Malian authorities, trained and advised troops to fight against the terrorist threat. It included about 700 soldiers from nearly 20 European countries. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch accused an al-Qaeda-linked Islamist group and the mainly ethnic Bambara Dozo militia of killing 45 people in separate attacks on villages in central Mali in January. Mali plunged into crisis following the 2012 outbreak of a jihadist insurgency, which has since spread to neighboring Burkina Faso and Niger.
We'll start this round of spins with a pro-establishment narrative from Euractiv. The EU's withdrawal from Mali is the latest sign of the deteriorating ties between the West and the Malian military junta. Given the worsening security situation in the country and across the region, the EU troops' departure, following Mali's decision to expel France, is a disaster for the people. However, the EU channels for political dialogue and technical cooperation remain open if the junta decides to put the people's interests above its own.
RT is going to counter that with the establishment critical narrative. The news that EU troops are finally leaving Mali is good news for the country, which is tired of the US-led West's interference and paternalism. The Western media ignores that it was the NATO attack on Libya that destabilized Mali and the entire region, and that the US and its EU vassals are, therefore, themselves to blame for the spread of Islamist violence they claim to fight. Mali is an impressive example of how Africa is freeing itself from the shackles of neocolonialism.
And the nerds from Metaculous say there's a 60% chance that Mali will experience a successful coup d'etat before 2040.
I've noticed the Metaculous prediction community's on a coup d'etat kick, so to speak.
For sure, at least the ones we're putting here, I think.
Anytime there's some sort of civil unrest in...
Yeah, they are on a coup d'etat kick. It's like,
I don't know, they've got a certain je ne sais quoi for the coup d'etat.
Yes. I put that in a cologne bottle. A whistleblower says Boeing plane parts had serious defects. Here are the facts as agreed upon by BBC News, The Hill, CBS, The Daily Mail, and The Guardian. A former quality inspector at Spirit AeroSystems, Boeing's largest supplier, has claimed that he often noticed planes with up to 200 defects being shipped out of the factory. Santiago Paredes, who worked for Spirit for over a decade, also said he wasn't surprised when an entire 737 MAX door plug blew off an Alaska Airlines flight in January. He further claimed that while working at Spirit's factory in Wichita, Kansas, it was very rare for him and others to not find defects with the plane bodies. Dubbed the showstopper at Spirit for frequently pointing out issues, Paredes said he faced pressure to minimize defect reporting because doing so would delay deliveries. In April, another Boeing whistleblower claimed that the company absolutely fostered a culture in which inspectors faced retaliation. This follows the deaths of two previous Boeing whistleblowers, the first of whom died in an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound, with the second one dying of a sudden illness that resulted in pneumonia. Two Boeing 77 MAX plane crashes resulted in 346 deaths between 2018 and 2019.
Thank you, Melissa, for the facts and the story. We're going to start these spins with a narrative A provided by CNN. The overall integrity of Boeing's planes is beyond question because they undergo rigorous stress testings and real-world inspections, and they show no signs of fatigue even after years of service. Boeing has also adapted newer standards since its 737 MAX disasters to balance safety, quality, and regulatory compliance.
Here's narrative B from The Guardian. Boeing hasn't given anyone reason to believe it's taking proper safety measures, especially when there are reports of an alleged criminal cover-up of their procedures. If left unaddressed, Boeing's lapses could lead to more catastrophe. Boeing has to prove it's getting itself in better shape.
Saudi forces were told to kill to clear land for an eco-city. Here are the facts as agreed upon by BBC News, Fox News, The New Arab, Middle East Monitor, CNBC, and Guardian. According to the BBC, citing a British-based former Saudi intelligence officer, authorities in Saudi Arabia have authorized the use of lethal force to clear land for a flagship eco-city that is part of its $50 billion NEOM project. Colonel Rabi Al-Anizi said that officers have been directed to kill anyone who resists eviction from the land sanctioned for the line, in a region whose inhabitants have reportedly experienced mass arrests for not complying with such orders. According to a human rights organization, at least 47 members of the Huetat tribe have been arrested, with nearly a third of them sentenced to 10 to 50 years behind bars under a counter-terrorism law. Five were reportedly sentenced to death. Additionally, satellite images have confirmed that at least three villages, Al-Kareba, Gayal, and Sharma, were wiped off the map for the NEOM project to move forward. This comes as Saudi Arabia dismissed reports over its alleged intentions to scale back in the medium term some of its plans, as Economy Minister Al-Ibrahim spoke at a special meeting of the World Economic Forum last week. NEOM and the line are part of Saudi Arabia's plans to diversify its economy away from oil dependency, with the futuristic city being envisioned as a car-free city. By 2030, only a mile and a half of the 105-mile project is expected to have been finished.
Those were the facts. Here are the spins with a pro-establishment narrative from the Washington Post. Saudi Arabia has no regard for human rights. Using lethal force against peaceful protesters is not only a gross, disproportionate response, it violates the villagers' human rights to life and property. The Crown Prince obviously cares more about his kingdom's economic interests and his image than he does about human lives or the well-being of his country's residents.
The establishment critical narrative is coming from the NEOM website. The area that NEOM is being built on is largely uninhabited, making it the perfect blank canvas for a project of this scale. though some villagers will need to be relocated, they are being compensated for the inconvenience. This innovative project will be a groundbreaking site to test solutions to some of the biggest issues humanity faces, providing not only a large amount of environmental sustainability, but also a high quality of life for future residents.
And the nerds have a say from Metaculus. There's a 50% chance that the population of Neom will be at least 101,000 by 2028.
Oh, a 50% chance, you say?
I do indeed. Spain's ex-soccer chief will stand trial for kissing a player. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the New York Times, the Associated Press, CNN, France 24, The Guardian, and ABC News. Spain's former soccer chief, Luis Rubiales, is set to stand trial for kissing Jennifer Hermoso at the Women's World Cup medal ceremony in August 2023, in addition to other allegations of corruption and misconduct. Previously, Judge Francisco de Jorge in January ruled that the kiss was unconsented and carried out unilaterally and in a surprising fashion. Rubiales faces one count of sexual assault for the kiss and one count of coercion for allegedly pressuring Hermoso to publicly support him following the kiss. Spanish prosecutors are seeking a 2.5-year prison sentence. The judge also confirmed Wednesday that Jorge Vilda, the former coach of La Roja's women's team, and two officials from the Spanish Football Federation would also head to trial for the alleged coercion of Hermoso. Rubiales has denied all wrongdoing, calling the kiss a consensual peck, with Hermoso rejecting the notion that the kiss was consensual. A date has not yet been set for this trial. In October, Rubiales was banned from national and international soccer activities for 3 years after he was found to have violated FIFA's disciplinary code.
Melissa, thank you for the facts on that story. The spins beginning with a narrative A provided by The Telegraph. While Rubiales' kiss was inappropriate, he's far from a criminal, and more than 2 years in prison would be ridiculously disproportionate. In the era of hashtag MeToo, punishing Rubiales so harshly for a mild offense may have the unintended effect of validating those who feel the movement has gone too far, undermining the country's progress in women's rights.
The Guardian brings us narrative B. This case is a much-needed reckoning for sexism and women's rights in Spain. Sexual harassment like this unfortunately happens far too often. Rubiales must face the consequences of his actions, and hopefully this can serve as a lesson for men in the future that non-consensual acts like this are unwanted and criminal.
In our final story today, a deaf toddler hears after a gene therapy treatment. Here are the facts as agreed upon by The Telegraph, Guardian, BBC News, and Independent. 18-month-old Opal Sandy from Oxfordshire, England, who was born deaf due to defective OTOF genes, can now hear, quote, almost normal for her age, including soft sounds, such as whispers, thanks to a new gene therapy called DBOTO. Due to a faulty gene, Opal was born with auditory neuropathy, which disrupts nerve impulses that travel from inside the ear to the brain. As part of the DBOTO trial, which lasted 16 minutes, she was infused with a working copy of the gene. Opal's sister Nora, who's 5, who has the same condition but uses cochlear implants, which bypass the damaged sound-sensing hair cells and directly stimulate the auditory nerve. Opal received the therapy in her right ear and has a cochlear implant in her left. Opal is part of a trial being run by Cambridge University Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust. She began in September, and her positive hearing results came roughly 24 weeks later in February. Opal's trial consists of 3 children like her who will receive a low dose of the gene in one ear, with another 3 set to receive 1 high dose. Up to 18 children are being sought to enter the trial, with a follow-up to be had 5 years later. According to a surgeon at the NHS Foundation's Trust, an estimated 20,000 people across the UK, US, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain have auditory neuropathy caused by OTOF defects.
Thanks for those facts, Adam. We'll start with narrative A from EMBO Press. Recent gene therapy breakthroughs are not only exciting because they're helping children hear, but because these studies have resulted in no adverse effects. As scientists continue to cure deafness for these rare genetic disorders, these results will hopefully help further research for hearing-impaired people around the world.
The New York Times has a follow-up on that with a narrative B. These treatments, unfortunately, seem to be fully effective just for those born recently, whether for deafness, muscular atrophy, or any disorder. Current gene therapies for older people can only slightly mitigate the symptoms they have set in over long periods. More research should be conducted into fixing these disorders at all stages.
And the nerds have the final say from Metaculus. There's a 50% chance that there will be 97 gene-edited babies born worldwide by the end of 2029.
Oh, if Big Brother has his way, they certainly will.
Gonna edit their genes. They're all gonna be Gap.
I was gonna go Levi myself.
Thank you for listening to the Verity Podcast for Friday, May 10th, 2024.
Each day we use machine learning to read about 5,000 articles from about 100 newspapers and figure out which ones are about the same stories. For each major story, our editorial team then extracts both the key facts that all the articles agree on and the key narratives where the articles differ.
For more information, you can visit our website, verity.news, or download our app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. For Adam Clark, I'm Melissa Topshire, inviting you to join us next time on Verity.